Colgan Air loses a Q400 over Buffalo. Alaska pokes stick at Virgin America. Boeing deferrals grow. And Cessna fights back. We're talking with Benay Wilson from Aviation Week this week on episode 35 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Airplane Geeks podcast, episode 35. This is Courtney. With me, as always, is Max. Hello, Max.
Hey, Court. Hello, everybody. Happy to be here.
Joining us this evening is royalty, as we find out from talking with her. But it's Benay Wilson. She's the online managing editor for business aviation for the Aviation Week Group. Your Highness, welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
When we first were starting with introductions, I said, how should I refer to you? And she said, Your Highness works. So I don't think she really thought I'd say that.
Never underestimate what Court might do.
Yeah, you can't underestimate me. Just a couple housekeeping items. We want to make sure that we throw out our support for Flightline Internet Radio again for what they're doing over there. Also, don't forget that the newsletter you can find on the website. Sign up on the upper right-hand side, put your email address in, and I just kind of send out some of the news articles that we talk about on the podcast, as well as some things that we didn't have time to talk about or were news articles that that were posted after we posted the podcast. I guess that leaves us with just one thing, and that's to get into the news. What do you guys say we get started?
Let's go.
First up today, we're talking about the crash in Buffalo with the Q400 that killed 49 people in the aircraft as well as one on the ground. This from Quran.com says the NTSB plane crew saw significant ice before crash. The crew of the commuter plane that fell on a house, killing all 49 people aboard and one person on the ground, noticed significant ice buildup on the wings and windshield just before the aircraft began pitching and rolling violently, investigators said Friday. Continental Connection Flight 3407 bound from Newark, New Jersey, went down in light snow and mist, ideal conditions for ice to form, about 6 miles short of the Buffalo Airport, plunging nose first through the roof of a house in the suburb of Clarence. All 44 passengers, 4 crew members, and an off-duty pilot, as well as one person on the ground, were killed. 2 others escaped from the home. The article does go on to say it was the nation's first deadly crash of a commercial airliner in 2.5 years. After the stroke of luck that we saw with the Hudson ditching, it wasn't long before we saw a rather unlucky accident, unfortunately.
Yeah, certainly a terrible accident that we hate to see. Looks like perhaps icing was at play here.
The CBR, apparently they had it out. It was in the tail. The tail was rather intact, which is where the cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder are on that aircraft, I think on most aircraft. And they had it out. And what was surprising was they had results the same day, which was something I didn't expect. But the crew was talking about significant ice on the aircraft before the crash. They did not mention it to ATC. Benay, you had spoken a little bit about the ATR crash for Eagle in Roselawn, and you were pretty familiar with that. What kind of similarities do you see?
Well, it was really interesting because, I covered the regional airlines for almost 10 years and covered the Roselawn crash pretty closely. And the thing that I remember when they talked about the Continental Express crash and they mentioned the icing, the first thing I thought about was Roselawn because the NTSB back then had determined that the accident happened as a reverse, a result of an aileron reversal because of ice buildup on the wings. And then, there were questions on whether this crew had turned on the pneumatic boots to break up ice. And, you know, we won't, you know, the investigation's still going on, so it's really not good to speculate. But the similarities did kind of strike me.
Certainly. I think a couple things that did come out of this the last couple days after the crash. One was the flight data recorder, according to the standard news agencies we all watch, CNN included, they said that the flight data recorder showed that the de-icing system had been activated prior to the accident, and that the separation, or the excursion, as they call it, from controlled flight happened when they went from 0 to 15 degrees of flaps. What's really coming into question here is the de-icing system that tends to be standard on turboprop aircraft. And it is different from jet aircraft, just even from the basic fundamentals of it being a de-icing system rather than an anti-icing system that the jets use. Anti-icing system that you see on turbojets, just very simply, they heat the wings. They heat the front of the wing and usually the front of the tail, and ice can't form. The de-icing system, however, that is used and was used on this aircraft involves rubber boots, that they call them, on the front of the wings, and they have to wait till ice forms. They then inflate those boots and it pops the ice off. So a very different philosophy in how the boots and the de-icing system operates versus the anti-ice system. This is what the investigators seem to be looking at. And Benet, if I remember correctly, the ATR accident had to do with ice being built beyond the protection. Do you remember?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, you know, the NTSB has got something interesting out on this issue, icing, and particularly on ice bridging. If you look at the NTSB site, I noticed that right up at the top, they've got a link to a safety alert on de-ice boots. And besides mentioning that it only takes as little as a quarter of an inch of ice to create a deadly situation, they bring up this issue of ice bridging, and I guess the notion is that do you wait for a certain accumulation of leading edge ice to build up before you activate the de-ice boots, or do you activate the de-ice boots, or do you activate them right from the start? And what the NTSB said.
And that was a question that came up 10 years ago at Roselawn, and it's something that still hasn't been resolved. But I was watching the news this morning, and after Roselawn, Canada decided that they would just require that the de-icer be on, and FAA, for whatever reason, just decided not to deal with that issue, even though
exactly.
It was one that was recommended by NTSB.
Yeah, the NTSB says for 60 years, pilots have been taught to wait for a prescribed accumulation of leading edge ice. In theory, ice bridging could occur if the expanding boot pushes the ice into a frozen shape around the expanded boot, thus rendering the boot ineffective at removing the ice. And then they go on to say that the safety board has no known causes where ice bridging has caused an incident or accident, and has investigated numerous incidents and accidents involving the late activation of de-ice boots. So the NTSB seems to have a point of view, a belief on this practice. But, as you say, Benet, the FAA has not taken action on it that's consistent with what the NTSB would like to see.
Yeah, and it's difficult too, in diagnosing the crash and how it's actually going to affect aerodynamics, that being ice, in that as soon as the airplane hits the ground, all the ice probably fell off, and if it didn't, it certainly melted off in the fire. Yeah. So any evidence is completely gone. They call it the ice bullet. Hopefully we find an answer. That's about the best we can hope for in this, that we find that it's definitive what happened, that it's an easy fix, and that it gets fixed right away. That's very difficult to do. So.
But it's something that we'll continue to watch, of course.
Certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, moving into our next story. This from AOPA Online, the AOPA website. Fuller supports FAA funding bill in congressional testimony. AOPA President Craig Fuller told Congress that AOPA members strongly support the new FAA funding bill just introduced in the House of Representatives. The bottom line for us is that we support the measure, We support the use of aviation fuel taxes as a means of support from our segment of the aviation community, Fuller said in his testimony February 11th. He noted that General Aviation had agreed to do its share to support ATC modernization by accepting an increase in aviation fuel taxes rather than user fees.
Yeah, this has been a really contentious issue with certain government agencies promoting a funding through user fees, particularly directed towards general aviation, and of course the GA folks being solidly opposed to that, and there've been a number of sort of acrimonious discussions about this issue. So it seems that it's been resolved now, or at least it's moving in the direction of resolution through the use of the fuel taxes as a funding mechanism.
Well, I mean, this was a battle royale, and I have a very interesting perspective because I was covering commercial aviation, so I was kind of looking at it from that side, but now I'm covering business aviation, so I can get, I have a better picture on the fight about the user fees. But I think it's just really interesting after just the acrimony over this whole thing, especially the user fees, that right. Now everyone on commercial aviation and business aviation are all on the same page.
It's good because not only does this get the FAA funded properly and at least I guess for the next 3 years, if I recall correctly, but it also lets some progress be made on moving towards the next generation air traffic control system, which everybody agrees is something that needs to be done.
No, I absolutely agree on that. And I think everyone is just tired of this dragging out, and they just want to get it done because this has been dragging on. It was interesting because I remember talking to some groups at the beginning of 2007 to get predictions on when they thought an FAA bill, reauthorization bill, would be done. And everyone kept saying, oh, it'll be probably right before summer recess. And then it just kept stretching and stretching, and everybody was like, oh, if we don't get something done before the election, we won't see anything until 2010. So it's going to be, it's interesting the way that this has been on kind of a roller coaster ride.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at least it looks like the ride's over. People are getting off the ride and ready to move forward in a productive way.
Now, if only we could get an FAA administrator to oversee all of this.
Yeah, I guess that's next, huh?
Beggars can't be choosers.
Yeah.
Okay, moving into our next story. This from Examiner.com. The Eskimo isn't smiling at Virgin America. This referring to the Alaska Airlines Eskimo. And if you had been a subscriber of the newsletter, you are aware of this, as we did include an article in this last week. Shortly after examining the carrier's first T-100 report, Alaska Airlines General Counsel filed a motion with the DOT requesting an investigation into whether Virgin America still meets corporate citizenship guidelines that were a condition of its right to operate within the United States. Virgin America satisfied the requirement and received a DOT operating certificate beginning operations in 2007. But the airline was required to overhaul its management structure and provide further information to the DOT proving its own citizenship before it could continue. This was something that came out after seeing how much money this airline is losing and how much difficulty they had in finding U.S. investors. And it looks like some may be ready to pull out.
Yeah, this reminds me of the discussion we had, I think it was last week, about airline alliances and how, they meet certain economic criteria when they're given antitrust immunity, but that things can change over time. And the question there was, do you revisit these kinds of arrangements? And it's almost the same thing here. At the beginning, at the very beginning, the Virgin Group didn't satisfy, certain requirements relating to percentage of U.S. ownership and made some changes and got those behind them. But then, Virgin America was beginning to run out of cash, late last year, they got an infusion of cash, from an investor, some investor who I think is not named in this report. And, you know, that sort of changes the balance, changes the percentage. So, you know, the issue is, do they still meet the requirements as they did originally? And if they don't, then what do? You know, you sort of dissolve the airline. I mean, it sounds kind of drastic.
Yeah. And, you know, they're in an interesting situation here in that I believe they are right at the bare minimum of 49% foreign ownership, 25% voting. So what happens if one of those domestic investors decides they want their money back?
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly, you know, that really hasn't been an issue as far as I can remember in any airline, at least in recent history. And what triggers that, at least the investigation into that? It looks like Alaska might be trying to trigger that investigation.
It really, you know, introduces some very strange, you know, economics and some strange behavior to this airline. You know, in addition to that, there's apparently a clause in the agreement with the privately held investors that they can sell their shares back to Virgin Group at, I think according to this article, at a predetermined price. Now, they haven't done that yet, but, you know, if a number of them started doing that, that shifts the percentage, you know, back to Branson, which can, you know, sort of upset the whole thing, you know, in that way. I don't know.
And it makes me wonder why that clause was even put in there. I mean, I understand that maybe the investors were like, okay, you know, airlines aren't exactly the greatest investment, especially this time, you know, that we're experiencing in the industry. But the reason why I ask about the clause is, you know, like you said before, I mean, this could upset the balance, the very delicate tightrope that they're walking on the
right
percentage of ownership rules. So let's say some investors say we want to sell our shares back. So Virgin has them. So what are they supposed to do? I mean, they can't. If they hold them, then they've broken the rules. And I mean, do they dissolve the airline? I mean,
yeah.
What do they do?
Right, exactly.
And another thing that was interesting in that report, first I have to give the shout out to Cranky Flyer, because he got those numbers, and I mean, he crunched them. It was just amazing to see, you know, all the work that he did on that. But the thing that kind of interested me was the unnamed investor. You know, why is this investor unnamed?
Yeah, you kind of wonder.
Yeah, and to mention Brett and Cranky Flyer, a lot of people seem to think that this lawsuit that Alaska is filing is some level of confirmation that Virgin America is already delinquent in their investor status. He makes the argument that no, not yet, that there are some advantages that Alaska has to maybe file the lawsuit preemptively.
The Alaska, when they made this, I mean, they cited media reports as part of their evidence. You know, the story saying that investors wanted to pull out and, you know, the whole thing. You know, I am convinced that, you know, they also saw Cranky's blog with all the numbers crunching. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, is this the way Alaska, I mean, I don't have anything against Alaska Airlines, but is this the way that they're competing? I mean, I'd really rather see them, you know, compete in the airline business in a little bit of a different way than try this.
Well, I mean, this has been going on since before Virgin even started flying. The airlines, you know, heard about this, and, you know, the millions that Virgin spent on, you know, defending itself before DOT and
right,
all the filings led by Continental and, you know, the other airlines. I mean, you know, they started a couple of years past when they originally wanted to start, because they were spending all this time and money trying to lower, you know, trying to prove the worthiness to the DOT. So,
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they didn't want to show their numbers, and they fought tooth and nail over it, calling it competitive. I actually interviewed David Cush about a year ago when he spoke at the American Association of Airport Executives meeting. He was the keynote speaker. And I asked him, I mean, why are you guys so adamant about not releasing your numbers when everybody else has to do it? And, you know, it's like in the story, he basically said the same thing, that, you know, it's competitive information. We should be allowed to, you know, get a toehold and a foothold in the industry before we have to reveal those numbers, because then our competition can look at it and, you know, do things that'll make it more difficult for us. And looks like that's just what's happening.
You know, and there was a flawed argument from the beginning. I mean, they're arguing the philosophy of the law. They weren't arguing what the interpretation of it. And I mean, let's face it, they had to have known that, but still, by refusing and by going through the legal process, they gained the time they were looking for.
Right.
Now, Alaska, and in kind of in response to you, Max, Alaska has been sitting back, the most affected by Virgin America's route structure, one could arguably say, with their West Coast network. And they've been watching Virgin America do what, in their perception, is massage the system, like we said, without filing their DOT until they simply had to.
And, I mean, if it hadn't been Alaska, it would have been somebody else.
Certainly. Okay, moving on to the next story. This from VietnamNet. AirAsia gives 500,000 free seats to stimulate air travel. AirAsia on Tuesday started to offer 500,000 zero-fare tickets for customers to book for its flights to and from Vietnam and other regional destinations as the latest move of the largest low-cost airline in Asia to stimulate air travel and tourism in the region. Han, who is the station manager of Thai AirAsia, a Bangkok-based member of the AirAsia group, said, "The free seats for the customers would still require them to pay airport tax and administration fees of some $57 for a trip between Vietnam and Bangkok, and about $41, this is all in U.S. dollars, for a trip between Vietnam and Kuala Lumpur. So even though it's free for the airline, it's not free for the customers per se. But still, $41 isn't bad.
That's still pretty cheap.
Oh, I would pay it.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, AirAsia isn't, I guess we have mentioned them a couple times on the podcast, Max, but really it's kind of Asia's version of Ryanair. At least that's what it seems from all indications so far.
Yeah, I think they were the first, I think they were the first low-cost airline, kind of in Asia. They're based in Kuala Lumpur. They started operations, I think it was in 96. They weren't very successful at first, and I think around 2001 they were purchased by a former Time Warner executive, Tony Fernandez, for a dollar, not a dollar, but whatever the currency is in Malaysia, I forget. And he turned it around, and they've got a pretty interesting low-cost airline. One report I saw says that their passenger break-even load factor is just 52%. So that's obviously quite low. But
it's interesting because what they did was it's kind of like deregulation in 1978 here in the States. They basically made it affordable for just about anybody to fly, whereas like in the United States before 78, it was considered a luxury, a high-end purchase, and they turned it into the Greyhound of the skies, and they've been very successful with it.
I was going to say, 500,000 tickets, free seats or free except for the tax, it sounds like a lot, but there really was a small window for booking these seats. It was between February 10th and the 15th, which is today as we record this. And it had to be for travel between October 12th and January 31st. So I don't know how many of those 500,000 near free seats they gave up. That would be an interesting figure. But it really is kind of a you know, quite an interesting, you know, sort of marketing move. I can't see many other airlines trying something similar to this.
Well, and you hit it on the head, Max. It's a marketing move. I mean, let's face it. You've got 5 days to book travel 8 to 11 months out.
Yeah.
And during a time when it's, like our winter season where it's generally people don't travel as much. It's kind of the low season. So, I mean, it's actually a good gamble on their part.
I agree. Absolutely. Now, I have to wonder if there isn't some support from, say, the government or the tourism bureaus or whatever they have over there, kind of a subsidy for doing this. And I have to ask, is this a sustainable model? My gut tells me no, but Ryanair has been doing something of the sort for a while. And Allegiant, which is doing the same type of thing with its agreements, not necessarily with governments or tourism agencies, but with hotels directly. And they're kind of subsidizing their own flying with the ancillary revenue, very well, I might add. But are we starting to see more collaboration between, say, the tourism industry and the airlines directly?
Well, I think it's kind of inevitable. I mean, the airlines have, you know, been doing what they can. It just seems to me a natural evolution. And with the AirAsia, you know, they've got their website, goholiday.airasia.com, where they've partnered with more than 50,000 hotels to put these people who are taking these 500,000 tickets. And you can't, I mean, I would have to think that AirAsia would get a piece of whatever lodgings people booked through that website. So I see more airlines taking a look at this model if it brings in money, you know?
Certainly.
And that's a region, I think, is it's really, you know, tourism is a big part of that region, and the opportunity to expand that is pretty great too. It's interesting that, you know, at my 30,000 feet site, the two regions where I get the most action, the most, email and, you know, other traffic concerning, air travel are India and Vietnam, that area in there, Southeast Asia. So, I think that, you know, you kind of, you know, hit it on the head when you talk about, you know, airlines looking to, you know, partner up and create sort of a, you know, an entire travel experience or holiday experience for potential customers.
Okay, moving into the next story, this from Aviation Week. We were kind of conned into this by somebody who worked there. No, I kid. this story, it was something that came out this week. It's official. Canadian geese or Canada geese hit flight 1549. Looks like they're narrowing in on a cause, which we all already know what it is, but the article reads, the Smithsonian Institute's Feather Identification Laboratory has identified DNA matter found on both engines of U.S. Airways Flight 1549 as belonging to the terrorist Canadian geese, Bronta canadensis, or something. Okay, not terrorist,
but Canadian geese.
They're Canadian geese. They generally weigh between 5.8 and 8.7 pounds, larger than the bird ingestion standard for the engine. And might I add, they're mean. Approach a Canadian goose, because it will try to bite you and threaten to crash an airplane into the Hudson River.
No, they're really very just not pleasant animals at all.
No, they're not. And you know what? I did learn something today about some bird control, not today, but this week, about bird control techniques. We've all talked about, you know, how some airports are using unorthodox methods as far as using falcons, using scarecrows, dogs, air cannons. I hear that there is one airport, in fact, Wilmington in Ohio, uses swans. Why, you may ask? The swans go to the ponds. They stay in the ponds. And they are territorial and keep the geese away.
Chasing. That's
and interesting. The swans don't fly very often at all. So whether or not that's true, I don't know. But I thought that was at least interesting because
it
that's lesson
good.
Number two. Don't approach a swan. It's worse.
No, you know what? That's really interesting because, you know, I have friends that work at airlines across the world. And United was having a geese problem, and they brought in two swans. So I actually can confirm that
that's
this
fantastic.
Works. They brought in two swans to help control the geese that were really just getting out of control at corporate headquarters. So I can actually confirm that the swan thing does work.
Well, I think the what the lab is trying to determine next, now that they've identified that you know they're Canada geese, is to figure out if they're migratory geese or resident geese, because you know you can take different paths to prevent a recurrence of this in the future if you know that. I know in a lot of areas, including where I live, each year the resident goose population has been growing. They're not leaving for the winter and migrating in such great numbers. And so that's what they're looking to find out. You know, is it the local population or was it just somebody, a flock that was, you know, happened to be flying by?
And, you know, that, as far as such a congested area for them to be flying through, there was actually another story where the Association of Canadian Geese also backed the fuel taxes rather than the user fees.
Oh, the poor goose gets no respect.
Yeah, the goose gets no respect.
But you mentioned it from the article. The requirement for the engines is a 4-pound bird. Which covers most or many of the birds that are ingested, but a Canada goose is significantly larger than that, and I think you can go out and see the bird ingestion tests on YouTube and other places like that, and they've certainly been very popular since this incident, and you put a large bird through a jet engine and it gets pretty dramatic.
Okay, moving on to the next story. This from Air Transport World. Boeing prepared for possible 10% 2010 production cut. Boeing Commercial Airplanes president and CEO Scott Carson said the manufacturer is cautiously optimistic regarding 2010, but is prepared to cut aircraft production rates if necessary. He said that if carriers begin deferring aircraft for longer time frames, production cuts may be necessary next year. He downplayed predictions by some, including ILFC chairman Stephen Udvar-Hazy, that production cuts could be as high as 35%. He says, my guess is closer to 10% if we have to cut rates.
Well, of course he's going to say that. on the business aviation side, I mean, you're just seeing cancellations and deferrals left and right. It would be shocking to me if we didn't see the same on the commercial side. And I think 10% in 2010 is very optimistic. I don't know if I would go as high as Mr. Udvar-Hazy. 35 seems a little high, but, I mean, he's been in this business much longer than I have. But I think somewhere in between would probably be more than reasonable for the industry to expect.
There was a in the current issue of Boeing Frontiers, which is the sort of the in-house Boeing publication for Boeing employees primarily. Scott Carson was interviewed along with the president of their military business, but he was asked what are the big issues that Boeing Commercial Airplanes faces this coming year, and I thought it was interesting the four things he mentioned. The first was the delays in the 787 and the 747-8 programs. The second issue that he brought up was delivering fewer airplanes than expected. Third was a reduction in the workforce, and fourth was some restructuring that they've done at Boeing, but certainly the big issues are the program delays and keeping the backlog sold. Deferrals doesn't change the backlog, but it changes the timing of the backlog, and that can have a big impact, obviously, on production rates.
I'll tell you what was surprising to me reading through Frontiers was the what they called snapshot of the backlog. Looks yes. into the characteristics of exactly what aircraft are in the backlog. It was a surprise to me to see that 61% of their backlog Why does that not make sense, Max?
Yeah, 61% is the intermediate twin aisle, which is the 777 and the 787. But the 787 component, that's where you were going probably.
Yeah, that is where I was going. I just read the wrong number. The 787 comprises 40% of Boeing's backlog, which is the largest component of their backlog, the second largest being the 737 at 32%. Again, we've kind of talked about this throughout the last couple podcasts, that the word failure and 787 starting to be thrown into the same context, and we're not seeing it. This is still such an enormous portion of Boeing's business. In fact, it is the largest portion of Boeing's business.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just amazing. I mean, just a lot riding on that. And, you know, with the industry downturn, and, I mean, we've already started hearing of 787 cancellations. And, you know, Delta has been very coy about what they're going to do with the order that Northwest had. So it's going to be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, it is.
The last story, moving in, this from AAN Online, says, Cessna, business aircraft are good for business. Cessna Aircraft yesterday kicked off an initiative to debunk myths about business aircraft and outline how these machines make companies more competitive. The reality of business aviation is a far cry from the misconception of CEOs flying in large, luxurious airplanes, said Cessna Chairman, President, and CEO Jack Pelton. This website that is at the core of this initiative is CessnaRise.com. And they have on there the first ad that they created and published, but this is a website that just, it says what needed to be said. Let's put it that way. The ad, which actually Binet sent the ad out on Twitter, so hopefully if you were following Binet on Twitter, that you were able to see the ad earlier this week. But the ad's called Timidity, and it reads: Timidity didn't get you this far. Why put it in your business plan now? In today's corporate world, pity the poor executive who blinks. The good news is, in trying times like these, fortune tends to favor those who make bold, decisive moves. It's simply about adjusting, not retreating, starting with a good hard look at your flight department. Are you flying the right aircraft for your missions? Can you adjust capacity to meet demand? One thing is certain, true visionaries will continue to fly. Because in tempestuous times, leaders recognize it's not about ego or artifice. It's simply about availing yourself to the full range of tools for your job. Rise.
Brilliant.
Amen. This has been nuts. I started writing about business aviation right before Christmas. I saw the whole thing with the auto executives flying to Washington.
Right.
And I kind of shook my head. I was like, oh, that doesn't look good, but, you know, it shouldn't be that bad. And ABC got a hold of it, and it just exploded. And it didn't help that November for television viewers is sweeps month, so you get all the fun, sexy, controversial stories that generate a lot of buzz. And I kept waiting for business aviation to react, to come back. Now, you had the usual. You had NBAA. Ed Boland has been doing great work. But, you know, NBAA, that's what they're supposed to do. Their members pay them to do that.
Exactly.
And then, you know, you had Gamma. You know, there were people out there, but none of the direct, like the companies and the manufacturers, nobody was doing the direct defense. And we kept getting these stories, and you had Congressman Barney Frank in his TARP legislation to reform TARP put a clause in there, you can't use business jets. And it's like, okay, people, you know, these are tools. I mean, I think about GM. When I wrote about the regionals, GM got some Saab 2000s to kind of go to some of these smaller towns. I mean, they've basically shot themselves in the foot because they have suppliers that are in places where there are no commercial airports, or if there are, there's maybe one or two flights a day.
Right.
That can really add up and hurt your business. And never mind the fact that we've got Americans, I mean, normal, you know, 9-to-5, Joe six packs out there building these aircraft. And these people are being put out on the street. And people, that message is not being put out. So I really applaud Cessna. And I don't know, did you guys see that Hawker Beechcraft had jumped into this too?
Yeah, I did. And they're really kind of pushing the King Air with...
But I give Hawker Beechcraft credit for even just coming out and doing this. And what I think what would really be interesting is to see some more companies coming out and saying, you know, this is what we have and this is why we use it. Mm-hmm. But instead, I mean, everyone is scared. Nobody wants the spotlight put on them. And I understand that. I mean, I did a blog post about Starbucks. You know, they got a new G550, and they were getting rid of one of their older aircraft that was less fuel efficient and everything. And they at first defended the jet, and then, you know, they had to announce their earnings and they're closing more stores. And, I mean, they barely had it a month, and it's already on the market. And they're getting rid of, they have three aircraft, they're getting rid of two of them. So it just, you know, it's like penny wise, pound foolish, you know, because again, Starbucks has operations worldwide that aren't always accessible to, you know, the commercial passenger service.
Absolutely. And I've been on my rant before. In fact, we even named an episode because I ranted so much. So I'll try to limit myself a little bit this time. But it's so entirely frustrating to me to see the public reaction to this. And I'll tell you, it is very difficult to justify this to, you know, Joe the plumber, to use a horrible reference. One that
horrible.
I really wish had never
horrible.
Would come back, but I did it. I can't believe I did it. But, you know, blue-collar Bill, we'll call him.
Okay.
Because one of the main arguments for business jet, we all know this, is because it makes the best use of your executive and even your managers, shoot, even your low-level technicians, time. Now, how do you quantify that? Because we're all talking money here. You say, well, let's see, they make this much a year, and if we're using this much of their time, okay. They automatically come back and say, well, then you're paying them too much, which is completely outside the realm of the argument and
exactly.
has so many issues of its own right and delves into the question of, you know, how capitalism works in its own right. But that's why it's so difficult. Rationalism is not a requirement of the media. And that is why we're seeing this overreaction. And might I add, too, by the way, that two of the main stories that came out in the last week, this being the week after President Obama told Citibank to, quote, fix it with the new aircraft purchase for $50 million, he then proceeded to fly Air Force One from Washington, D.C. to Richmond, Virginia. So I wonder how efficient that was. And then with the stimulus bill passing, they launched a business aircraft paid for by the White House to retrieve one of the Ohio senators who was at her mother's funeral to make sure that she made it back to vote in time.
And can we go further on? I mean, can we go a little further on that? I mean, the Speaker of the House has her own plane.
Sure.
If you think about all the federal agencies, DOT, the Pentagon, Customs, Immigration, the Coast Guard, I mean, we can go on. They all have business jets, and they use them for legitimate reasons. And, I mean, I'd like to meet the congressman or senator that hasn't taken a ride on a business jet for convenience.
Right. And, you know, I mean, that's where the argument is. And it has to be pushed the right way, because as soon as you say, well, look at how much the government uses this, they say, well, the government needs to. And the problem was that Citibank was being bailed out for their inadequacies. What is government but a bailout by the taxpayers? And yet they are still allowed to use this. Is it a question whether or not they should be allowed to engage in business aviation? Absolutely not. We've already established that it is an important part of business. It makes sense. $50 million on a jet is going to save you probably $200 million in what could have been lost accounts or whatever. That's already been set. The government should not be pushed to get rid of it. They should stop pushing other people to get rid of them. It's absolutely ludicrous. And add into the fact that, I'm going to throw out a number, probably 80 to 90% of the business aviation industry manufacturing side is in the United States. It baffles me why they would do that.
Yeah, these are American jobs. These are people that are hardworking, like our neighbors and friends, and you know, they're out on the street. I mean, I just did a story a couple of weeks ago. The United Way of Wichita, they're opening up a one-stop shopping job center for people, all the people that are losing their jobs because of aviation manufacturing. And you know, it's just a shame because it's so unnecessary. And I think that, and I have to, of course, plug my boss here, Bill Garvey, who is the editor-in-chief of Business and Commercial Aviation. A week ago, he had an op-ed piece in the New York Times entitled "The Mile High Office," and he did what I thought was a very good job of explaining just how these jets are used and what it means not only to the companies that use them, but the American economy, the global economy. And I just thought he did a great job in outlining that. But, you know, here we are still with this argument.
This article needs to find its way into USA Today or to CNN without them laughing.
But they don't want to hear this type of story. It's much sexier to say Citibank is getting federal money, our taxpayer dollars, and yet they can go out and buy this extravagant jet. That's a story that sells. That's what gets the ratings. They don't want to hear, well, Citicorp has canceled this jet, and others have followed. So, people are losing their jobs. You know, that's not as sexy. Unfortunately, and until the industry gives CNN or the general media a news hook that they can kind of sink their teeth into, it's going to continue.
We are, as we had predicted, pushing time a little bit. So I do want to sneak into the main topic just enough to ask you about what you do at Aviation Week and give you a chance to talk about your writings there.
Well, I started on business aviation right before Christmas, and we have a newsletter called The Weekly of Business Aviation, and then we also have Business and Commercial Aviation Magazine. And then on our website, aviationweek.com, we have the Business Aviation Now blog. And I write mainly for The Weekly of Business Aviation. I also blog extensively. I do podcasts. I do a little video. I have a Flickr account where I was shocked to find out I have more than 3,000 photos of airports and aircraft and aviation related. So basically, I'm the social media online new media guru for the Business Aviation Group.
Did you find that there? Are you finding that Aviation Week is receptive to sort of the new media approaches, or do you have to do a lot of convincing to get things to happen?
They're getting there. I've been very fortunate because I've gotten a lot of leeway for what I've done, and I've actually gotten rewarded for it. So, they're open to it, and I mean that's one of the reasons why I went over to the business aviation side, because they're like, we want you to kind of duplicate this. But I just think it's kind of the future of the journalism business, having all of these skills. I mean, I graduated from college in 1985, and I had a degree in broadcast journalism, but I did an internship at the local Fox station, and that was enough to kill any desire for television. So I went into print, and now it's like, it's funny. It's like I'm full circle now because, you know, before all I had to have was a notebook and a pen, and I have this huge kind of Swiss Army knife backpack with a camera, a video camera, the digital recorder, my little tripod, and you know, it's just, you know, I'm a one-woman studio now.
Fantastic. Yeah, the technology has really changed, how they how you can produce, good content.
Certainly, and of course, Twitter is kind of the piece that we profitize.
Yes, and I'm on Twitter, BizAv Weekly. That's me.
And yep. Binet is very active as well. So there's a very strong group in the aviation journalism sector now that Cranky's on there as well.
I dragged him kicking and screaming. I take credit.
And we gave him a hard time for that. So make sure that you follow Binet if you want all the latest and greatest of aviation news. You said BizAv Weekly, right?
That is my Twitter name, yep.
Right. Now, Binet, one thing that we do want to do real quickly here, even though we're running out of time, is our word associations. Very simply, we're going to say a word or probably a couple words, and just tell us the first thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Okay, I'll start with the first word is just simply readership, and I mean the people who read what you write.
Passionate.
Aviation folks tend to be kind of passionate, huh?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I get emails and calls and people, I've been subscribing to Aviation Week since 1954. They're just very passionate about the industry.
Okay.
Great. My first phrase, if you will, the future of regional airline turboprops.
Iffy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that the industry has changed drastically. I started writing about it in 1992, and that's when turboprops were king. Comair had just gotten its first CRJ. So, I mean, I've kind of watched it from the peak and to the trough, and, I've seen a lot of consolidation, a lot of, just a lot of change. And I think that as the major airlines continue to kind of cut back on their fleets, they're going to be looking across all sectors, I think. And I don't think the turboprop will ever completely go away, but I just wonder how its future is going to be, in the next 10 years or so.
Interesting. Okay. Next for me is print media.
Dinosaur. And it pains me to say that. I have just become evangelical about how important it is for print journalists to recognize that the newspaper that's delivered at your front step every day is just, it's going the way of the dinosaur, and that your skills have to expand. What you do, I mean, you don't just write a story anymore. I write a story, I think about podcast possibilities, I think about video, I take my own pictures. I mean, this is where our industry is going, and I've actually gone and spoken at conferences. I call myself an old school journalist teaching new media tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, when I started in the business, I started on a typewriter. So, I hear older journalists saying, I'm too old. No, you're not too old. I have a child to feed. There's my motivation.
Okay, my next word, Binet. Corporate flight departments.
Fading.
Forever?
I did a story a few weeks ago with David Siegel, who was formerly the CEO of U.S. Airways. He is now with a California-based company called ExoJet. And basically, he has a fleet of Citation 10s and Challengers that it's kind of this hybrid. You can do charter, and you can do kind of a fractional without actually owning the plane. You just buy the hours, kind of like a marquee card. And we were talking about this, and he said that there are a lot of companies, after what's been going on with all the scrutiny, that are looking to get rid of their flight departments and looking for a way to still have, their private flights, but without having the expense of a flight department on their books. And I think with all the scrutiny that's going on, I don't think that corporate flight departments are going away. But I think companies, especially the publicly held ones, are going to take a good hard look to see if the expense is still worth it for them.
Even though it would most likely end up in a higher expense. I mean, it seems like they want it off the balance sheet, but they're willing to take a much larger hit on their income statement just by classifying it as an expense rather than as an asset, rather.
Well, I mean, I think every company is going to just have to take a hard look and decide what they want to do. But I do think that, companies are going to take that look because, it's like you said, they do have that expense, but you have to think of the intangibles, of your local congressman or senator coming down on you, especially if you're a company that's taking federal money. I mean, we go back to the Citicorp example.
All I can say to that is boo.
No, I agree. I mean, it's just, so again, that's another example of sometimes being penny wise and pound foolish.
Yeah, I agree. Very well said. Yeah. Very well said.
Okay, my third word you actually sort of touched on, so I'm going to punt and try this. I'll just kind of open it up and say simply the future of aviation. And after you're done with that, you can address world hunger and world peace.
The future of aviation. I don't want to say bright. I'll say consistent. I don't think that aviation is going anywhere. I mean, we still have to get from point A to point B quickly and at a price that people can afford. But I do see that there's probably going to be some more evolution. I wouldn't be surprised to see some consolidation. I wouldn't be surprised to see what we were talking about earlier, airlines looking for even more ways to kind of pump up the model to bring in more revenue, a la what Allegiant is doing, mm-hmm. partnering with more people and, looking at that model. So, I think we're still going to have, the services that we have. Although smaller communities, it's going to be a little tougher for them going ahead.
Great.
Okay, but name my last word, airplane geeks.
Love.
Aww.
Love, because I am one myself.
Absolutely.
And I mean, I think that airplane geeks in general and you guys specifically are just wonderful. And it's what keeps this industry so interesting to cover. I mean, the passion of the people that are in it, and I include myself in that. I've been a geek since I was 6 years old, so I come by it honestly.
Binet, we didn't say this, at least I don't think I impress it enough, just how much of an honor it is to have you with us. Thanks again.
Thank you. I am so glad that you finally asked me. So, give it a few months. You call me, I'll always come on.
And let that be a lesson to all you great industry people out there. Don't wait. We think you're too great and almighty, so contact us. Binet, again, your Twitter name so people can follow you?
I am at BizAvWeekly, and you can always see what I'm up to on our website, which is aviationweek.com/biz, B-I-Z.
Again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Binet. Max will now give you his pick of the week.
Yes, my aviation website pick this week is Smart Aviation Picks, P-I-X. And you can find that at emin.home.comcast.net. And what this is it's kind of a fascinating airplane ontology mashup, which means it collects and organizes airplane information, including photographs, from a variety of different sources like Flickr and the social database Freebase, and from Wikipedia airline specifications, and I think a few others. So, for example, when you with a click, you can bring up all the Flickr DC-3 photos if that's what you're interested in, and you can even further refine your search by selecting from the photo titles or from a tag cloud. Or you can call up information, let's say, on the B-29 from Freebase or Wikipedia. And there's also an option to create sort of an airplane data and photo mashup from all these sources. the technologies behind this are pretty interesting. The page uses something called Simile Exhibit, which is I think now a Google toolbox of web widgets and APIs that originally came from the MIT Simile project. And with that, and I'm quoting from that website, you create interactive, data-rich web pages without ever touching a database or a web server or doing any programming. So it's kind of an interesting technique that allows the author of this site to go out and grab all this information from all these other sites and put it together into one website. Smart Aviation Picks is initially focused on general aviation and commercial airplanes, but it looks like they're going to grow that to include some other types of aircraft. And that's my aviation website pick this week.
Thank you, Max. We do have some listener feedback. Actually, this came in through the comments on the blog for each of the episodes we post. This is from Johnny Plain, and he is from Airvation. Or Airviation, I guess I should say. He says, great show as always. Wanted to comment on the House transport story. If they pass this bill, it would just open the door to more regulation. Very dangerous considering all the things the government has been doing lately, like the LASP. The less regulation, the better. Thanks, John. And John, again, his blog, which I'd like to mention because I don't think I had seen it before, and I did enjoy it, is Airvation. And you can check that out at airvation.com. Hold on.
Yeah, I think it's Airviation, right? A-I-R-V-I-A-T-I-O-N.
It is.
That's it, right?
And I apologize. I screwed up the address. It's airviation.wordpress.com. So we'll throw a link on the site as well.
I know this blog.
I think I've seen it before, and I just forgot about it, so I apologize to John, because it's a very nice blog. I wanted to make sure that I mentioned it. I also want to point out that we mentioned this before, but we have the list of the guests that have been on Airplane Geeks podcast. If you go to airplanegeeks.com, on the top you'll see a menu of some links. Click on guests on the podcast, and we have each of them as well as which episode they were on. So by the time you're listening to this, you should see Binay Wilson, episode 35, and I'll probably have some witty little title to go with it.
It's our rogues gallery.
It is our rogues gallery.
It's great.
So check that out, and if look down, and if you miss some of the original Airplane Geeks, pick your favorite person and listen to that one. That's what we do.
Yep.
If you would like to contact us, you can do it by sending us email thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can also do as John did and leave a comment on the blog. We do check those. Also, you can give us a call and leave a voicemail. That number is 812-757-4252. Bring straight to voicemail. Give us a call, and we'll get you on the podcast. You can also record yourself and send an MP3 to us directly. We'll get you on the podcast. And if you're worried about sending us email because we'll say your name, just ask me not to, and that's no big deal. But rest assured that nobody embarrasses themselves over the internet airwaves more than I do, so it can't be that bad.
Yeah, I was going to say something, but I won't.
Thank you, Max. As always, we do appreciate your support. Write a review for us on iTunes, Podcast Alley. I suppose we're still on there somewhere. But as always, and really the best way that we ask everybody to show your support, not only for us, but for the entire aviation and the new media community, is to simply tell your friends. That is by far the best way, and we do appreciate that. Don't forget, you can follow us, the Airplane Geeks, directly on Twitter. Airplane Geeks is our Twitter handle, so follow us there. Don't forget to also follow Binay at BizAvWeekly, right? Did I get that right?
Correct.
I did. And other than that, Max, I think I've covered all the ways that they can contact us. Is there anything I'm missing?
You can our own Twitter names. You can find me at Max Flight on Twitter.
And my Twitter account is Miller22. If you'd like to follow me directly, I think that's about it, huh? Binet, again, we can't thank you enough for joining us. Really, this was a lot of fun. And we went long like we knew we would, but I think it's all very good content.
Yes, and thank you again for having me. I'm very happy to do this.
We're glad to have you.
Max, I think that about does it for episode 35. Join us next week with yet another exciting guest on episode 36 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We'll see you guys.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
I had something to say. It was important. It was great.
It was great.
It was earth-shattering. I don't even remember what it was.
A great moment in podcasting lost forever.
It was. It's now lost forever, relegated to the depths of my subconscious, I guess.
You'll probably think of it when I'm doing my pick of the week, and you'll interrupt or something.